Thank you, Noya, and thank
Alrighty.
You, Fusilier. Welcome, General Mick Ryan. He has just joined us right now. Thank you, sir, for joining us.
Hello, everyone. Good morning, and to those down under, happy Australia Day.
Happy Australia Day.
That day ends with a Barbie and a beer in hand, but
I think it begins with a Barbie and a beer in the hand.
Right. So we're not going to discuss the content of the diet of Australia today, but I presume it will involve a lot of raw meat in that regard. Thank you very much for joining us this evening, General. It has been a pleasure the last time, and I hope it will be yet again for our audience today. Lots of things have happened since last you spoke to us here. I just wanted to come back to what we discussed once before, and that when orders are made and Ukrainians receive material, that they make very quickly very good use of them. You've just been writing about the development of Ukraine's strike complex and the fact that they are now moving operations further into Russian territory because they have a couple of capabilities more which allow them to do. Can you speak to this?
I think this has been a really fascinating strategic and national endeavor to watch over the last 2 years. Ukraine's long-range strike capability was really given up at the end of the Cold War. If we recall, in 1994, they signed an agreement to hand back nuclear weapons as part of the security guarantees from the US, Russia, and the United Kingdom, as well as they sold off some strategic bombers as well. So they've lacked the strategic strike capabilities, but they've redeveloped that. It was pretty rudimentary at the start, using old jet-powered drones and things like this, special forces. They have, over time, developed longer-range strike missiles for maritime operations, the Neptune and the upgraded Neptunes, the uncrewed maritime strike vessels, which are semi-submersibles and even submersibles now. In the land domain, they now have everything from GLMRS and ATACMS, which are launched by HIMARS and MLRS. They have air-launched Scalp and Storm Shadow missiles. The ground launch small diameter bomb is just arriving in Ukraine. There's an array of long range drones that are either indigenous or provided by countries such as the United Kingdom, Australia, and others that are used in this strike complex. They have a very impressive arsenal. That is not the only component. You need the ability to find targets, to prioritize them. Their reconnaissance capacity has had to expand both with their own resources as well as those of their allies, United States, NATO, European countries, and others. Our process, the NATO joint targeting process, is what they use. All these things are important components. And of course, you have the assessment regime, and then you have a security regime to protect this entire strike complex, everything from weapons to aircraft to drones to missiles of these kinds. I think over time, this has been an extraordinary achievement by the Ukrainians. We mustn't forget that a lot of the targeting is often provided by either by human intelligence, special forces, or Ukrainian civilians in occupied territory, acting at great risk to themselves to serve their country in a way that isn't always seen by people further away.
The interesting thing is that we saw initial signs of this last year, and actually even towards the end of 2022 in the occupied areas close to Melitopol, then we saw the effectiveness of what seems to be a, by now, a little bit more calmed down, and because they've been there for long, partisan activity. We've seen part of it when Kherson was freed, but predominantly when Crimea saw more and more strikes throughout the last year. This is now being exported. Belarus, Rostov-on-Don, Novorossiysk, even St. Petersburg are not safe at all.
It's clear there are several classes of targets. Some of them are very operational or tactical, but many of them span that operational to strategic realm. I think the first one, and probably the most success in their strike complex, has been Black Sea operations to deny the western reaches of the Black Sea to the Russian Black Fleet and to deny it the ability to civilian maritime vessels that are exporting the Ukrainian goods, agricultural and other things, which are really important to earn foreign currency and underpin Ukrainian economy. Before the war, about 50% of Ukraine's GDP was earned through exports through the 13 seaports. That's a really important topic. The second one clearly is Crimea. There are multiple reasons. It's an important operational and strategic logistic hub for the Russians, important operating location for its aircraft and for its Black Sea fleet. It's also an important support hub for ground operations in the south, and it's an important political target for Ukraine. So Crimea, I would class as another strike complex priority. A third one clearly is the array of operational support elements in occupied Ukraine and Western Russia, whether it's airfields, whether it's logistic locations, troop concentrations, command and control facilities. That's a class of strike targets. And I think the fourth one, which is coming into focus over the last probably 4 to 5 months with more clarity, is Ukraine is attacking Russia's oil and gas transportation and export facilities. There's probably been around at least a dozen attacks on these across Russia in the past 6 months or so. Last year, Russia's earnings from oil and gas declined by about 20 to 25%, on which economists you listen to. If Ukraine degrades its export and its shipment infrastructure, not only does it have an impact on how much Russia can export, it has an impact on the confidence of its customers to have further contracts with the Russians. I think they're both important objectives for the Ukrainian oil and gas targeting campaigns. I think they're the four major categories, at least in the physical realm. Then, of course, the fifth is strategic influence operations. That's almost a whole different category.
It sounds a little bit like the efforts undertaken by the U.S. Air Force in their flights on Poesti in Romania during the Second World War, as to what we can see now, has hit Azovstal, Yekaterinburg, Chelyabinsk, Tumen, even further out. Exactly those spaces which are also harder to repair. They're further out. They're very important, both in terms of metals, but predominantly in regard to exactly what adversaries want to export, and that is oil and gas. If you can hit TNKs, if you can reach and touch them as far as Tumen, that is quite an achievement for a nation without long-range air bomber power.
Absolutely. It's what has been a demonstration of is Ukraine appears to be able to focus on the outcome and then build the capability to achieve it rather than we want a bomber and then let's see what we can do with it like other countries might do. So I think a few things go into the construction of this strike complex. One is necessity, particularly when you're fighting someone against Russia. If you just keep fighting the soldiers they send, that's going to be very difficult. You need to go deep. You need to be able to conduct deep operations against its war-making infrastructure across the diplomatic, the economic, the military, and a range of other things. When you're fighting a war of national survival, it allows you to do things at pace in a way that you just can't do otherwise. I think most Western countries are still wading through the leftover lethargy at the end of the Cold War. We're starting to get it, but if you have a look, investment in industry across the West at the moment, it's still lagging. It's still behind where Russia is, and where there's probably another big wake-up call to come before Western politicians really invest in the kinds of capabilities we're going to need to push back against the authoritarian quad.
That being said, isn't it also what you indicated earlier that there is a bit of political agenda setting and marketing in this effort? Touching Russia, hitting Russia, hurting Russia, impairing, degrading their logistics capacity is an important feature in convincing the allies that not all is lost, because the gloom and doom easily promoted, taken up and purported by Western media as part of Russian propaganda must be fought in some shape or form. It seems that strikes like the Kerch Bridge, as it was referenced, as well as further, say, publicity relevant, logistically even more important targets are the flavor of the day, are they not?
I think in some respects, the Ukrainian strike complex is maturing just at the right time. It's going to be a year where Ukraine is largely on the strategic defensive. Even now, the last 24 hours out of Washington indicates, with the coronation of Trump as a likely Republican contender, makes a deal in Congress for Ukraine even less likely, which is just catastrophic for Ukraine, heartbreaking for its citizens and its soldiers and for those who support the country. this strike complex becomes even more important to the Ukrainians to say to people, no, we're a country that can still fight. We will fight on. We are worth supporting. And please pay attention, because if you don't support us in Ukraine, you might have to support Poland or Estonia or Lithuania next.
I've spoken to some of our Finnish friends in recent days. They said, we've always been ready. We'll just get even more ready in the north now.
I think Finland is in a different class of military readiness to just about every other Western nation. Clearly they have a very different context from the rest of us, but I think there's also a lot we can learn from Finland, and we should be learning from Finland.
It's interesting that we have so many different capabilities and traditions, as well as learning environments, militaries all across NATO. If we could just manage to coordinate ourselves a little bit better and set the political aims clearer, I think we wouldn't have to discuss, like our British friends are currently doing, how to find a way out of a 75,000 men under, or men and women, understrained, undersupported, underfunded army, right?
I don't wonder whether the year of the all-volunteer military is over. It's actually a pretty recent kind of thing. Both world wars were fought with drafted, conscripted militaries. The all-volunteer construct really emerged out of the American experience in Vietnam. I think it's done well for 40 or 50 years, but I just don't think it's going to see us through the next few decades. Even the Athenians knew that you had to bring people into the military, even if they didn't want to defend the city-state. I think democracies, if they really want to defend themselves, are going to have to insist that citizenship isn't a one-way you get things from the government. Citizenship in democracies is about you serving your country, even if that means as an ambulance driver or a firefighter or a tree planter. I think citizen service to the state is something we are going to have to do. It's just, is it sooner or later?
My colleague M has hand up.
Sir, over the last few days, several videos have been coming out of Ukraine of FPVs being used against Russian armor. Yeah. We're seeing those small FPVs taking out pieces of armor that cost hundreds of thousands of dollars, even millions of dollars to build. Given the fact that, sir, you focus on war in the future and how we can imagine future threats and how we can defend against them, now that APSs or active protection systems have been all the rage for quite some time, do you envision a world where we have to start building similar systems to protect against FPVs and other types of aerial threats for armored vehicles and other types of vehicles, namely systems that can either take them down by shooting at them or use EW to take them down?
This has been something I've been writing about since the start of the war, is that countering uncrewed systems has not seen the same level of investment as uncrewed systems over the last 30 years or so. It's really hurt us. It certainly hurt the Russians as well, thank goodness. I think you're starting to see a lot more investment in both the hard and soft kill approaches, whether it's targeting the uncrewed systems themselves with spoofing, with soft kill, hard kill, capturing them, targeting their control stations, targeting their manufacturing and supply networks. I think we're starting to see that. The problem is that it's still cheaper to run an uncrewed system than it is to shoot it down quite often. Not every sense, but in the broad. So what we need to develop are counter-crewed systems complexes that are cheaper per shot than what the drone is. Now, whether that's directed energy, whether it's a mix of directed energy, which might be microwave or lasers, very low-cost missiles and a range of things, but we need to turn countering drones into a cost imposition exercise against those who want to use drones. We're not there yet. In fact, I'm about to publish a paper with retired US Air Force General Clint Highnote that covers this exact topic. That'll come out in the next month or two. It is a big challenge. It's a big operational challenge. It's a industrial challenge, which we have not made as much progress on. It's not that we made no progress, but we have not made as much progress on it as we need to.
Thank you, sir.
All righty. I wanted to switch gears once more and back to something which we've been discussing right after two items. Let's start with the first one. When directly after General Zaluzhny came out with his treatise and op-ed interview in The Economist, which caused a bit of a stir because people didn't, not everybody was able to read the tea leaves clearly or actually read what he wrote. Ukraine, as you said very early this year, should and is most likely best advised to embrace the inevitable, meaning make positional warfare your friend, gain strength when military capabilities have been reached and the Russians degraded further, strike back harder, meaning have air power, more long-range missiles, better inventory for artillery, hopefully upgraded troops at hand. Is that the name of the game at the moment?
I think the problem with positional warfare is the vast majority of people don't actually know what it means. They just think it means stalemate and they have a view of trenches and World War II. It's actually not what it is. I've written a couple of pieces on this and there's been some really good papers over the last 20 or 30 years about what positional warfare is and how it fits in the trinity of positional warfare, maneuver warfare, and attrition warfare. The fact of the matter is you need all three. You just need to emphasize different elements, different phases of a war. 2024, for a variety of reasons, including the amount of resources expended in 2023 on the counteroffensive, the shortfalls in both the EU money because of Orban's silliness, the shortfalls in military assistance because the US Congress, that's 50% of military assistance that's just been blown away, for a variety of other reasons. I think this is the year for reconstitution, for long-range strike, for strategic influence, and targeted attacks on the Russians to rebuild Ukrainian offensive capacity for 2025. I think, too, the counteroffensive showed a lot of heart, a lot of courage, but it also showed there are some weaknesses in the Ukrainian armed forces, particularly operating at scale concurrently, that need to be sorted out with training, education, leadership development, communications, these kind of things. I think 2024 positional warfare is Ukraine's friend in the broad, but that doesn't mean it's not without political and strategic challenges.
Before we come to the political and strategic challenges as a consequence of this, one element in this is also that the positional warfare would predominantly now allow the Ukrainians, it would require them, but also allow them to rotate out forces. Essentially, nixing recent statements by President Zelensky, who for political reasons and part of his, agenda, did not really promote what all his general staff, as well as NATO generals, including General Cavoli, when having been there on site, I think it was, what was this, in July last year, had already heard that Ukraine has an issue with rotating out frontline troops. Have an issue with rebuilding, reconstituting, training, upgrading troops because it simply lacks young, alert, quicker healing, more athletic Ukrainian males. They should be army age from 27, right?
I thought that age was interesting. I'm sure there's a lot of reasons, including demographic reasons, that probably want younger people to go and have families and stuff. At the end of the day, most people, when they conscript people, they start at 18. War's a young person's game. It really is. Having done 35 years in the army, it gets tougher every decade. I appreciate the political difficulties that Ukraine has with the next round of mobilization. But the unfortunate fact is that in wars like these, democracies sometimes have to do things they are uncomfortable with. But they do them, whether it is World War II bombing cities, dropping atomic bombs, they do them because that is the lesser of two evils. I think that is the case here with mobilizing more people in Ukraine. I understand the ideological opposition to forcing people to serve their country. I intellectually understand, emotionally I disagree with it, but I think mobilizing 500,000 Ukrainians is probably the lesser of two evils when it comes to Ukraine defending itself this year and ridding itself of this brutal Russian war over the next couple of years.
Now, at the end of World War II, we just highlighted this thing. At the end of World War II, and I'm not coming to the question of the 750,000 or 850,000, sorry, Purple Hearts, which were printed in anticipation of the invasion of Japan. Unfortunately, they didn't have to be expanded because somebody made the right decision. Because if people want to go into this topic with us, they should. There is a wonderful book, Operation Downfall, by John Greco. I can only recommend it. People should read through it, and they will probably end up pale and shell-shocked. Having said this, General Line, the Ukrainians at the moment, they would technically need the same kind of mobilization level as the British had during World War II. The Brits had, across all armed forces and across all service, a little over, I just had to correct myself from what I thought was the number, a little over 5 million service members in all the armed forces for a population of slightly over 42 million. This is quite comparable to what we see in Ukraine. The war is existential. The war has signs that it requires this kind of cycle. We're currently at a strength somewhere in the region of 950 to a million. The armed forces, Konrad Schuller, with that I finish the question. Konrad Schuller, senior editor and co-publisher of the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, has been yet again in the past weeks in Ukraine, was on our space and highlighted that across various frontline forces, officers, NCOs, soldiers, the likes, he heard the same thing. They are tired. They're not desperate. They're not giving up, not at all. They're fighting, but they are tired. And they need they don't understand why their politicians don't do it.
Now, I have 100% sympathy with those soldiers and leaders on the front line, and that they're doing the right thing. They're staying at their posts, but they're wondering why more of their fellow countrymen and women aren't there with them. Now, during the Second World War, the Americans, as they were thinking about mobilizing in the late 30s, looked at how much of a society can you mobilize and put in uniform? And they came up with a figure, 10%. If you read through how the U.S. Army mobilized, U.S. military mobilized in the Second World War, they had a population of 140 million people. Their view was you could put 14 million people in uniform before you started to have a significant impact on things like industry, these kind of things. That's what they did, 14 million. About 8 million went into the U.S. Army, and the other 6 million were in the U.S. Navy, U.S. Army Air Force, and U.S. Navy. If you have a look at Ukraine at the moment, which has about 1 million people in its military, give or take a couple here and there, of which about 200,000 were full-time service personnel at the start of the war. So they mobilized about 800,000 people out of a pre-war population of 44 million. Even if we accept 4 or 5 million of those people are now overseas as displaced people, Ukraine is still well short of that 10% of your population in uniform. It's probably around the 2% figure. Can the Ukrainian society bear it? Most likely. If you're fighting a war that's existential, I think citizens have an obligation to serve. And if they don't do so freely, they should be conscripted to do so. I think that's the same in every democracy. And that is extraordinarily unpopular in the left wing and on university campuses, who would rather talk about our freedoms than actually do anything to defend them.
All righty. Now, before we go to the next topic, I can see that friend and colleague Will Teal from Perth has signed up.
Thanks. Hey, Mick. Happy Australia Day.
Thank you.
I think there's also some folks in the Department of Defense here in Australia and the government who are more interested in talking about liberal democracy and peace than they are actually doing something about it as well. We now have the Taipans issue is now dead. We've seen them cut them up and part them out. We still are doing a lot of surplus that could go to Ukraine, and we're selling that off for basically nothing after the supply chain for disposing of it gets their cut. And we still have F-18s for the last 15 months. That's for the this is the third time I've asked you about this over 15 months. What's wrong with the Department of Defense here? Are we just too scared of offending the Chinese? Have the Yanks told us we can't do it? What is wrong with us, the Department of Defense, that they can't step up and support Ukraine in a meaningful way or a continually meaningful way so that they can actually win here? Those F-18s in particular, we've been stonewalled with FOI requests. We're getting nowhere here. The last time I spoke, you maybe 3-4 months ago. Are we wasting our time here?
It's a lot in that question. If you wanted me to talk about what's wrong with the Australian Department of Defense, I could probably talk for about 3 weeks on that one topic alone. It's a combination of the Department of Defence and the current Australian government, which is left-wing, is not enamoured with engagement in Europe. The Foreign Minister is very focused on the South Pacific. She or her Defence Minister colleague are yet to visit Ukraine after 2 years. They don't perceive any votes in Ukraine. There's that piece that's pretty cynical. They'll talk about it, but when it comes to supporting it, they prefer just to rip old equipment out of defence rather than spend taxpayer dollars. There's that piece. In defence, it's just a classic case of a lack of imagination combined with focus on their own services without seeing a bigger picture of your services are more likely to be used if you don't support Ukraine. I published a piece this week with the Lowy Institute that looked at an Australian strategy for supporting Ukraine, which advocates for a larger quantity of aid, a broader range of aid beyond military, the reconstruction fund, supporting humanitarian mining, financial assistance, a whole range of things we could be doing, which we are not. We can do more diplomatically, return the ambassador. Now, as I said in the piece, if our ambassador can stay in Port Moresby through years of riots and can stay in Tel Aviv through months of rocket attacks, why can our ambassador go back to Kyiv, which has the best air, missile and drone defence system on the face of the earth? It's that. When it comes to Department of Defence, what I advocate for and I will continue to advocate for, and I've spoken to different people about this, is defence's process for disposing of equipment needs a mandatory step where Ukraine is considered as the disposal location of any bit of equipment we want to get rid of, whether it is cold weather jackets, whether it's a truck, whether it's a helicopter, whether it's old pistols or boots. It should be mandatory. The first step in the disposal process in the Australian Department of Defence is that would this be suitable and safe for Ukrainian soldiers to use? If it's a no, we go, great, no worries. You just write why that is. If it's a yes, you go, okay, let's talk to the Ukrainian ambassador. I think that one thing alone, and if you want to have a writing thing about anything, that one thing alone would fundamentally shift how aid is provided to Ukraine. There's a myriad of political and bureaucratic reasons why we've been pretty risk adverse and unimaginative in our support for Ukraine at this point. We need to keep chipping away at it. We need to keep writing to politicians, talking to them, giving them easy solutions, because Ukraine needs everyone's assistance more than ever.
Mick, let me just follow that up. Mick, I've written those exact same things, said those exact same things multiple times, but writing up a 5-page reference paper with footnotes and all that to it, get absolutely no response out of defense or the Australian government. I'll keep chipping away, but I don't expect to even get an answer, which is disappointing to me because we are supposed to have a transparent and accountable democracy here as well. Yeah. It's one thing that the Albanese government in particular has said that they were going to be honest and transparent. In comparison to the last government, they're simply not.
No, I agree. There's a fundamental lack of transparency in Australian governance across the board.
All righty. Without also avoid talking about the Taipan, by the way, if I may say.
I think that's kind of an issue. There are other things to focus on. Axel, while we're speaking, and I know Philip Reese is online, if I could just mention,
sure,
Becca's birthday, Becca the combat medic. She's on Twitter. You see her stuff. Becca, the redhead medic, who has been supporting Ukrainian soldiers for a long time now. It's her birthday today. If you can support her and her fellow combat medics, that's a great thing, because as we all know, combat medics save lives every day, and in this war have saved the lives of tens of thousands of young and not so young Ukrainian soldiers. It's just another way we can help the Ukrainian military and the Ukrainian people. Happy birthday, Becca.
Absolutely. I brought old Philip up. Philip, good evening.
Good evening. Not quite. I'm in Switzerland, so it's good evening still. But I just 35 minutes ago sent Becca my birthday wishes to her, but have not heard back. I guess she's busy as always, as we know. Excellent.
All right. No, but absolutely. And thank you, Mick and Philip, for highlighting this, because this is what we should be doing. We should also spend time to appreciate those who actually fight on location, who are the real heroes. And that's the people who actually go into the trenches and take those boys out and get the golden hour up and make sure that they're treated.
Absolutely. She's just one of many, but she could be a symbol of many people who are doing amazing things every moment along that very long and dangerous front line.
Yes, and she's terribly effective. I don't want to know how much medical supplies she's been able to get to the people fighting in the trenches. Must be an insane amount. She shared, for example, that the White Angels in Avdiivka, they have IFACs that she provided them with. When she showed me the video, I recognized the IFACs right away.
If people can donate on buy me a copy, a lot of us have done it in the past. Anyone who wants to, $5 or whatever you can afford, that'd be fabulous.
All right. That's a very good cause. Thank you for that. We have a couple of hands up. I can see John Howard is coming up. That's grand. We also have Pizadier with us and Nuno Felix. Nuno.
What?
The big names today.
It's a pleasure to talk to you, General. First of all, I'll give you something I've bought and read like a maniac through White Sun War. Okay. It's the best thing I've read since Red Storm Rising. Seriously.
Thank you.
Fantastic stuff. The first true glimpse of 21st century warfare beyond Ukraine. Chakra Rain is a hell of a name for an operation. To everyone, go buy White Sun War by Mick Ryan. It's an absolutely banger of a book. I've read it.
That's a great endorsement. Thank you.
I've read through it like in 3 days.
And now you get to ask two questions.
Now I get to ask two questions. First of all, a pleasure as always. One of the things I've spoke earlier today and I'd like very much appreciate very much your opinion on is our ever-growing concern with industrial production. We are facing a situation probably in the U.S. where the package, the financial package to support Ukraine is not coming through. Due to, we all know the background to that. With that, I would very much appreciate your opinion on how you see the next 9 months before Europe can and its production can probably be relevant to this. And also how you see it for your neck of the woods, the Pacific, because that's a very important key that this decision will resonate, I'm sure, in the Pacific. I very much appreciate that.
Thanks. No, great question. In many respects, Spetter, I publish a piece that looks at what I call the mobilization trinity. We've talked about mobilizing people, and we're about to talk about mobilizing industry, but we also need to mobilize new ideas. When it comes to industry, unfortunately, mobilization takes time. Even when you do make that decision, it takes time. If you ever look at the US, the arsenal of democracy in World War II, it wasn't the arsenal of democracy until 1943. They began that process about 18 months before Pearl Harbor. It took them about 3 years because the big issues with mobilizing industry, things like prioritization of scarce resources, metals, rare earths, these kind of things, you had to build new factories. It's not just good enough to say we're working two shifts today instead of one. You actually have to build new, bigger factories. And you have to establish whole new supply chains, and that takes time. But unfortunately, the Russians stole a march on us. They started this process with the partial mobilization directive in September 2022. We didn't really begin this until 2023. That said, Russia in this war is a bit like Japan in the Second World War. They knew they had about a two-year opportunity where they could possibly outfight and outproduce the Americans, but after that, they were done. The Russians are exactly the same. They have an opportunity this year. If the war's still going next year and Ukraine has support of the US and Europe, European and US industrial production, at least that we know about that's going to increase, will be greater than Russia's. If we make further commitments, Russia is in real trouble. They just don't have the productive capacity to compete with Europe, the United States combined. We need to continue that development, and the defense industry will not invest in expanded production without contracts. They really are reliant on government telegraphing requirements and paying for requirements to do that. it's going to be a tough year this year. Hopefully, if we can sustain the political will and strategic patience, we'll be able to rectitude, rearm the Ukrainians for larger scale offensives next year. In the Indo-Pacific, different ballgame, unfortunately, because Chinese productive capacity is just off the scale. They build more ships than anybody. They have a massive workforce that is able to be mobilized if required. In fact, they have a lot of flexibility with their workforce because it's a command economy and they can do things very quickly. Chinese industry is used to the design, development, and production of new products at a pace and scale that most Western countries can't match. The Chinese industrial capacity is a massive, massive issue for us all. If you want one example of that is DJI drones. They've cornered the market on drones. Hopefully things like the US Replicator and Hellscape will lead to more investment in US and other drone manufacturers. Because if the Chinese own the drone market, one, us buying them is investing in Chinese industrial and defense capacity. And two, it's an exploitable weakness. Russia has a capacity, but Chinese capacity is just, it's a whole order of magnitude problem that will be extraordinarily difficult to combat.
All righty. You had your hand up for a lot longer than John. You want to call on this and then we carry on?
It's a very short question. Sir, what kind of special engineering equipment do you think the Ukrainian armed forces need right now to turn the tide going forward?
I think the first thing we need is not worry about the equipment, but worry about how do you actually cross surveilled, denied spaces safely with enough mass to break in and break through. That's the problem we have to solve. Very similar to what the Brits needed to solve in 1917. It's what we need to solve now. We need to look at combined arms doctrine. Combined arms breach doctrine is obsolescent, right? It is obsolescent because of this combination of autonomous systems, this mesh sensor, civil military sensor framework, and democratized digital command and control. We need to come up with new ways of doing this. If I was to speculate when it comes to that whole approach to mine clearing, that it's part of a system which detects, maps, proves, and marks lanes through obstacles. I don't know whether main battle tank chassis are going to be the right systems anymore. My sense is there's less anti-tank ditches and more mines. It's going to be lower profile, lower signature systems in larger quantities that we're probably going to need. And some of these European remote control mine flails and those kind of things are indicative, but probably not quite that because they're too slow. But signature and speed and mass, I think, are the three elements of a technological solution. That technological solution must fit within a larger tactical idea about how to cross that surveilled and denied space.
Thank you. Good point. John Howard and Fusilier. We have lots and lots of people who want to come up. General Ryan, I hope this is okay. We have a couple more questions.
I've about 20 minutes left, mate. That's fine.
Excellent. John, good evening. Good evening. Your guest.
Good evening, Axel. Thank you. Good evening, General. Apologies. I missed the first 30 minutes of this. So if I'm repeating, let me know and I'll just go back and listen. General, have you seen Tony King, Professor Tony King, his most recent thread on Twitter?
I haven't seen his most recent thread, but obviously I'm a follower of Tony and read his books. So I think he's a great intellect and good bloke as well. I've met him. I think he's made a great contribution to thinking about warfare and this war in particular.
Okay, brilliant, brilliant. I'll summarize very briefly what he said because I want to contrast it with something else that I've heard just in the last few days. His view now is that the Ukrainians should basically look at, he doesn't have a lot of faith in a 2024 offensive and thinks it could go the same way as 2023. He's leaning towards effectively a modern Maginot line, giving up on, certainly in the short term, on thinking about trying to retake large tracts of territory. On the flip side of that, Anders Fogh Rasmussen, the former SecGen of NATO, I heard him on the Eastern Front podcast, the AI cast, just in the last few days. he's talking about Ukraine being ready for a spring offensive if sufficient equipment comes through. The point of this, what I'm trying to get to, there doesn't seem to be a common strategic view in the West. These are guys who are outside the US, and goodness knows what the Americans are thinking. There doesn't seem to be a common strategic picture of what should come next from the West. I'm just wondering if you haven't discussed that, what your thought is on that incoherence. Thank you.
I think one of the big problems with the Western strategy with this war is it's a commitment to defend Ukraine, not a commitment to defeat Russia. Until that shift is made, there's no real timeline. There's a as long as it takes kind of timeline, which is just a rubbish statement. If you commit to defeating Russia, that's a whole new ball game when it comes to strategy, when it comes to resourcing. They haven't done that. No one has done that, even a lot of people, including myself, have called for it in public. When it comes to a spring offensive this year, that's very hard to imagine being done in a way that could be successful with current resources. If Ukraine is still talking about re-equipping and mobilizing now, there's just no, on military profession, I commanded a combined arms brigade. You train all year for combined arms operations with people who would be doing it for years. A mobilized force, and they're still forming combined arms brigades. I mean, it's just trying to attempt that in spring, I think, would lead to a worse outcome than a 2023 counteroffensive. This is now a time for strategic patience, not rushing to failure. That will require a political commitment to defeat Russia and resource Ukraine in 24, 25 and beyond, not just say for as long as it takes.
You've written about it, and I think John is more than in agreement in this regard. This is all about the political will and the communication that this is to defeat Russia. Victory is defeating Russia.
Absolutely. I think part of the problem is, I actually think a lot of the political class is still in shock that this is happening in the modern world. They were told by the Steven Pinkers and the university professors that humans are too smart for big world wars and these kind of things. This has challenged the worldview of a lot of politicians. Because they were told these things, they never really invested in understanding national security or military affairs. There's still a lot of wishful thinking that goes on amongst politicians. We need to educate them and take them on a journey. So that era, that nice post-war, post-Cold War era, that doesn't exist. That's dead. You're in a very different era now where the authoritarian quad is coming for you and your democratic system. You have a choice to make about whether you're willing to defend it or not.
All right. John, you had a follow-up?
Just a very brief comment on exactly that point, if you don't mind. You probably wouldn't be aware, General Ryan, but General Sanders here, CGS, he gave a speech in the last 24 hours or so where he merely suggested that as a society, we need to think about the prospect of industrial warfare and within hours and what that would mean for society at large. And within hours, he'd been shot down by number 10. I would just say that certainly in our case in the UK, civil military relations is fundamentally broken. The political leadership have no idea how to manage this situation. It's very concerning, but I'll leave it there. Thank you.
I know Mr. Patrick, and we caught up on a couple of occasions when I was last in the UK, and I think he's a good thinker and a great leader. He's saying exactly what people need to hear. It's just politicians don't want to hear it. I think it's important that he's saying these things and saying them in public because governments have really lost the art of talking to their citizens. They certainly have in my country, probably have in Britain. We no longer explain things to our citizens. We message at them. And we need to get back to explaining things and being honest about some of the challenges we face. Now, is that speech, I guess that speech is online somewhere. I'd love to download it and read it.
I haven't seen it yet. It wasn't allowed to be given to TV cameras, so it's come through the prism of journalists, which is why I think it's been sensationalized. Then the politicians have responded to the sensation, which is, as I refer you to my previous statement.
It just says everything about politicians. They are response machines. They're not very good at anticipating, getting ahead of things like they should be.
It's also hard if you have your own personal political agenda, one of which is sort of, say, mollycoddled by overarching complacency surrounding you and adulation on the other hand, whilst you get elected, to then find out that essentially you have very little discretionary room and that the realities of life as a prime minister would probably dictate a lot more military and a lot harder work than you're aspiring to, because people like to be adulated too, right?
I think part of the challenge now too is that unlike what it used to be in Western democracies, the vast majority of politicians have done nothing else. It's now a distinct class of its own where they enter politics in university and all they do through their whole career is work for someone in politics and become a politician themselves. That trains them well for the competition to get elected, but it doesn't prepare them well to govern. I think we have a political class that's excellent, the cut and thrust of competing to be elected, but atrocious at actually governing wisely when they get into governing.
All right.
Clear. We are back down under.
Good morning, General. Happy Australia Day. I hope the weather's better where you are than it is in Doris this morning.
Yeah, it's pretty nice here.
Look, just following up from your laugh, I think I only ever did an 8-month stint in the Ministry of Defence in London. I worked for General Mike Jackson. He was the man who actually made me an officer. I watched a man with no filter trying to engage with those career politicians. It was amusing, but difficult. Given my age, I know Patrick. I knew his predecessor even better, given that I'd trained with him, Mark Colmsmith, and neither of those have particularly good filters either. I think actually, on a practical level, one of the issues is that you, me, anybody else who's been in the military for long enough and had relatively successful careers on whatever pathway they chose to do, we're just different animals, and it's apples and oranges trying to communicate. And they see everything through a political lens. We tend to communicate in a way that's alien to them. It's a practical issue, but until we learn to actually communicate with each other in a way that works, I think we're going to essentially have these difficulties, and they're probably going to compound over time. That was not what I wanted to say. You actually managed to steal my thunder as usual, General, in one of your previous answers.
Sorry about that.
That's okay. It started when you mentioned about, I actually commanded the company group that did the breach in 2003 into Iraq. That was a very well-resourced but quite a complex combined arms operation. We preceded that with 2 years of arms plotting from light infantry into armored infantry and then taking on the tanks. That was 2 years solid to get to CP level 5. That was across all three elements of fighting power, the moral, the physical, and the conceptual. It was a huge leap for us. I then commanded the battle group, and again, continual training. You as a formation commander will know that the level of training, the effort that goes into not just getting to CP level 5 or even close to it, but maintaining it. And therein lies my concern. We spend a lot of time concentrating on the physical element of fighting power, the equipment and the kit, less so on both the moral and the conceptual, the man and the doctrine. Obviously, I'm 13,000 miles away from Ukraine as are you, but you've probably got a better handle on it than me. What concerns me is that the collective West, the allies of Ukraine, are not doing everything they can to take those formations when they're resting, recuperating, and retraining, to train them out of the battle in exactly the same way as Montgomery took his divisions and brigades out after the first Battle of Alamein and trained them in preparation for the second battle. Really, one of the biggest things we could do, yes, Taipans and everything else, is actually give them the training they need to be able to do those breachings, to be able to do the operations that they need to be successful. I wondered what your view on that was.
I think that's an important way we can help Ukraine. It's not just a qualitative problem for Ukraine, of course. It's a quantity issue. I spent some time with the general that's in charge of Ukrainian ground force training. Is a former brigade commander, hero of Ukraine, energetic, adaptive, keen on making sure Ukraine army is with best practice. He also understands that they only have so much time because of battlefield casualties. They know that recruits need more than a month recruit training, but they just can't achieve that at the moment. Mobilization is going to be key, but also getting the best possible quality training in the limited time they have is important. I think
beyond the recruit stuff, that leadership training, which is where a lot of Op Reflex has gone. It's not just recruit training. There's a lot of leadership training. I know I helped prepare the Australians that go over and support the British effort there. I think platoon leaders, company commanders, battalion commanders, we need to get that piece right. Building good, how do you build a good combat team, or at least what's a combat team look like in modern war in Ukraine? What's a good battle group look like? What's a good brigade group look like? They're the three critical echelons I think we need to get right at the moment. And that requires, I think, enhanced leadership development as well as enhanced staff training, which need to, as a complementary but both vital undertakings. I was a brigade commander, then commander training and doctrine for our armies. This is a non-discretionary element of building an effective, professional and successful warfighting army. It's something we're going to have to keep working on in collaboration with the Ukrainians, because they know a lot of stuff. They've learned a lot of stuff. I think there are some gaps there that we might be able to help them with, and we should be helping them with.
This ties back in with what we discussed beforehand, both about mobilization. The tenor of the discussion said brought to the public by General Zaluzhny, as well as your own suggestion that 2024 is less likely to be the time when Ukraine can attack, because they won't have rotated out yet. They won't have rebuilt such forces. They need to train both the existing officer corps, upgrade the NCOs further. One of our friends is one of the leading trainers of the NCO school, of the TDF, for example. He says the very same thing. They need to, those who are still alive need to be upgraded, and they need to actually become trainers just as well. He highlights that, just like many others we've spoken to, it's not done with cycling in another 500,000 men, as President Zelensky seemingly declined to mobilize, because the war will continue through 24, definitely through 25. It's very hard to see, and unfortunately we have Chuck Farrow with us here, who has been preaching this with all of us here for quite some time, almost likely going into 2026, unless Russia disintegrates. That means 3 years, and that's at least 1.5 million men, which you actually have to build up, because you will lose some. You will have casualties of different sorts, both KIA as well as, let's say, those who lost limbs and the likes, those who should be can't fight any further, those who need to be rotated, upgraded, and you still need to have a larger force anyway. This is a hard task.
It's an extraordinarily difficult task. There's a range of different things that you need to balance. It's availability of forces, equipment, but you need to preserve a training workforce, which is a certain percentage of your force. The other complication that Ukraine has is that whenever it concentrates people in training establishments, they become a target, which most Western nations don't have. How much can you offsite in nations where they can't be attacked? That has a time cost and just an overall cost. It is a complex interaction of all those considerations, as well as the injection of constant learning and adaptation, because the battle space is changing constantly, because the Russians are learning, the Ukrainians are learning, there's emergent behavior that then has to go into training, doctrine, equipment, and things like that. This is a really tough undertaking. I think for me, I'd recommend to everyone Amy Fox's book, Learning to Fight, which she wrote a couple of years ago, that looks at how the British Army learned during the First World War across all its theatres. It's important because there's a lot of parallels between that institution and the Ukrainians, including the fact that so the British Army that existed in 1914 no longer existed in 1978. Didn't exist. Intellectually, it was fundamentally different. Physically, it was different because they're all dead. A lot of those challenges are common with Ukraine. The Ukrainian army of February 2022 does not exist anymore. A lot of the ideas do not exist anymore. The Ukrainian army of 2024 is different, and we need to support them in their ongoing adaptation and learning as they move forward, hopefully conduct big offensives in 2025 and destroy the Russians in detail.
Was it the bridge you were building to us and telling us that Amy's going to come to our space?
She's not able to at this point in time. I do recommend her book. It really is quite superb.
Can I just second that? I was the chief instructor of our senior Brecon course at the Infantry Battle School. which was a sort of bastardization of the older Tarpaul's infantry school that General Mick's referring to, and the German Kampfschule experience. It requires a great investment of people. You've got to take your best NCOs. The way those battle schools work is they take the best officers and NCOs out of units to train the next generation. That's actually a tough call when you're fighting.
I am just looking at the book here yet again because I was stunned when I first discovered it. And it starts with this beautiful picture of step into your place where civilians of different kinds of different parts of societies with bowlers and wigs and top hats and normal, you know, garbies actually march into the picture, and then all of them become soldiers. It takes a lot of time.
It sure right does. I've probably got time for one more question.
Right there. Good morning. Good evening, General. I think your third.
Good morning.
I think your third point earlier was about paraphrasing the ability of economies to innovate, and I was just curious as to how close to the grip on this problem you think we've got it in the West. Like you mentioned DJI earlier, but in terms of the amount of tanks and IFEs being blown up at the moment by drones, it's mostly these cheap FPV kamikaze drones. They're not made by DJI, but they are mostly made in China. I was wondering if you think we actually have a strategic vulnerability there, because as far as I know, the British Army has no doctrine, let alone anything to use for how you fight with an FPV kamikaze drone. I don't know if any other NATO country has a experience fighting with $500 disposable kamikaze drones. If we don't even use them, how can we access our potential vulnerabilities here? Because I've got an FPV drone on my desk in front of me. It's not a kamikaze bomb dropping one. Even though some of the key IP in that is British, actually, all of the parts are made in China. If our MODs respectively have never procured them and our armed forces have never learned how to fight them, how can we even assess our vulnerabilities here? I think replicators exposing personally how ill-prepared we are to actually assess our supply chain risk. But I'd be really interested to hear your thoughts as, well, frankly, someone who's in the aerospace industry and is a FPV hobby flyer just for fun and is very concerned.
I think you're right to be concerned. Despite the many strengths of armies, we can be conservative and can be resistant to outside ideas, let's say politely, at times. There's a variety of different positive and negative reasons for that. You are right. The density of uncrewed systems in Western military forces is insufficient, I think, to be effective in modern war. Worked perfectly in Iraq in 03 or in Afghanistan or the Gulf War in 1991. But 2024, modern war is very different because of those three key areas of drones, Sydney Mill sensors and digitized C2. You don't really understand unless you do it. You're aware of it because you're obviously going to watch it, but you don't understand the problem until you experiment and you test. And out of that comes different tactics, different organizations, different equipment requirements, and these kind of things. My sense is you're very right. We are seeing, if you looked at the Ukrainian army, and say the British Army, and looked at the ratio of humans to drones, it would be very different. My sense is the Ukrainians would have an order of magnitude more, and it's still not enough. The really interesting things for me from that order of magnitude change in the ratio of humans to drones is, first, it must change our tactics. It must change how we operate, how we undertake combined arms teaming and reteaming and grouping and regrouping. It must change how we train and educate our people, because a lot of the autonomous or semi-autonomous systems that we use have some measure of AI, some things that look a little bit like human cognition. So these are no longer tools that are being used by humans. These are tools that humans are partnering with. And I don't know about anyone else listening, but no military training system in the world trains people to partner with their tools. They train them to use their tools. It's an entirely different philosophy and a mindset that we need to change. The third element is leadership models. When you have different densities of humans and robots and algorithmic support, decision support tools, you're going to have to evolve how you select and prepare leaders
I think the Ukrainians probably have some lessons there for us, but I think we also need to do a lot more experimentation ourselves. The Marines have been doing it 29 times to really discover that we understand it and internalize it in our own institutions, but also show the people and leaders in our own institutions the need for change and that these different approaches are probably likely to lead to greater success in modern war, not old styles of war. With that, I probably need to head off.
Thank you very much, General. It has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much for also spending a few extra minutes. I'm very glad that you concur with Blackadder in Blackadder Goes Forth that essentially General Melchett should have been retired beforehand because he has never learned anything.
General Melchett should never have been a general, but that's just my view. The easiest person to replace on a battlefield is a general. And the whole system's designed to replace them. No, don't let anyone ever tell you that generals are indispensable or irreplaceable. We're not. Thank you, everyone. Have a great day. And it's been great to be with you again. Thanks for the invitation.
Very much appreciated. Happy Australia Day. Enjoy the barbie.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Sir.
Bye-bye.